Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Leslie Saul Garvin. Our thanks to the Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting tonight's event. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Larry Brilliant, chairman of Skoll Global Threats Fund and author of Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Dr. Brilliant is a board-certified physician in preventive medicine and public health. He lived in India for more than 10 years, working as a United Nations medical officer, where he played a key role in the World Health Organization smallpox eradication program in South Asia. He also co-founded the SIVA Foundation, an international NGO whose programs and grantees have given back sight to more than 2.5 million blind people in more than 20 countries. Dr. Brilliant was the executive director of Google.org and chaired the Presidential Advisory Committee on Biosurveillance. Through his work, Dr. Brilliant has collaborated with leaders and visionaries, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Steve Jobs, Wavy Gravy, the Dalai Lama, and President Barack Obama. Moderating tonight's conversation is Elliot Schrag, Vice President of Communications and Public Policy at Facebook. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Brilliant and Elliot Schrag.
So I want to thank everybody for coming out. We have a great audience tonight. It's a particularly impressive audience since the Giants are playing not too far away from here. And I think to the extent possible, if there are important updates, Larry has agreed that we can interrupt the conversation to provide, you know, real-time updates. It's very, very important.
In fact, maybe we could have somebody agree to do hand signals.
Exactly. The game is just about to begin. For those of you who've been here waiting patiently, and I know there were a lot of you, Cleveland did sweep their series, so they're going on to the ALCS championship. I can see that's much less relevant to this audience. We only have an hour, and Larry's led quite a life. So I do want to sort of begin by saying this is really challenging for someone who's interviewing, because the book, Sometimes Brilliant, really is several different stories. It is the story of how, you know, one of the world's most damaging and debilitating diseases was eradicated, and an extraordinary story it is. It is the story of a young man's life and growing up, and his struggle between science and spirituality, and I think we'll spend some time talking about that. But I think particularly because we're here at Osher and it's the JCC, I sort of prefer to view this as a cautionary tale for all Jewish mothers who think about asking their children to become doctors. Because the life that Larry has led is not the one you expect when you say, my son, the doctor. And I suppose maybe let's begin at the beginning. So begin in Detroit. What was it like growing up in Detroit, and how was your upbringing in Detroit in a good Jewish household leading you ultimately to become a physician?
Actually, growing up in Detroit was wonderful. You know, there are times and places where there are cities that are industrially based that have jobs for everybody. And you could come to Detroit from any place in the world and get a job. You could get a job on the assembly line or in the tire factories. And a city that has a job for everybody has less reasons to fight. So it was a wonderful place to grow up. I mean, in the 50s, we were way before the tumultuous social dislocation of the 60s. So there were wonderful relations of all the communities. It was a great place to grow up.
But even in the 50s, in your little neighborhood of Detroit, you were already connecting to broader national issues, and your father and the work that he did connected you, even at the earliest age, to sort of figures of national importance.
Yeah, I mean, I Are you speaking about Bobby Kennedy, or are you speaking
yes.
about NAACP? I mean, I remember being in high school, which was Mumford High School. We used to call it Pink and Blue Jew U, because it was painted pink and blue. And we lived in a Jewish community, and it was a mostly Jewish school, but not entirely. And when I was in the 11th grade, my entire 11th grade went down to sign up at the Detroit Central Methodist Church to join the NAACP. And it was a very progressive community that we lived in, at, even for, you know, certainly for those times.
What was it about growing up at that time that made the connection to the NAACP, or the awareness about what was going on outside?
You know, the neighborhoods were changing. The each successive wave of immigrants was accumulating a better livelihood and moving out to the suburbs. There were some bad things happening. The core of the city was beginning to show the hollowing out that would happen later. I think the automobile companies were too successful in getting the state to pay for highways. And as a result, the cars allowed people to move further and further away from the city and avoid taxes. And as the tax base left the city, there was nobody left to pay for schools, and we were beginning to see that effect. But that didn't really happen until the 60s. The 50s were really quite wonderful and very tranquil.
And so you were in Detroit thinking, this is a wonderful neighborhood, the world is around me, and was your ambition at that point to be a doctor?
It was my mother's ambition that I be a doctor.
And like a good Jewish boy, you said?
No, I was going to be a lawyer.
And so what was the path? Because it really, you know, it's what's fascinating is, as you read the book, you really share the discovery or the struggle, or at least the conflict, between leading a more traditional life and having rationality or the traditional sort of path you're expected to take, with these moments of connection with people who lead you in new directions. Is that a fair characterization, or?
Oh, I think, I mean, if we really want to bring it to the present time, my family and my community that I was in, we went to a dynamite public school. I mean, it was a phenomenal public school. The education that we got at Mumford was as good or better than at the private schools at Cranbrook and Country Day. It was amazing. We had three PhDs, you know, teaching us, and the kids were really motivated. So I think that we were intellectually curious.
I see.
And I think that intellectual curiosity was rewarded and accomplishment was rewarded. I mean, the traditional immigrant bargain that parents made was to push us, and we were all very pushed. I was by no means the top of my class. I mean, we had kids who were just phenomenal.
So the ambition was lawyer. Again, you have to tell the story about how you ultimately ended up going to medical school, because it's not a story that I think is one that can be easily replicated.
Well, I think the first thing, I went to the University of Michigan because I won a contest, and the contest was the Michigan Actuarial Society had a contest, and they awarded scholarships to Michigan for people who did good on their math test. And for some reason, I did really well on the math test. I hadn't been particularly good at math in school or particularly interested in it, but I won this state contest, and I won a scholarship to go to Michigan. Otherwise, my family wouldn't have been able to afford me going to Ann Arbor, to the University of Michigan. And I went there, and I was in my sophomore and junior year in between them, and my dad got cancer, and he died, and my grandfather died. And I was a very depressed kid. I was in my late sophomore year, and I'd kind of locked myself up in my dorm room eating burnt peanuts and reading comic books. And I might not have ever left that dorm room in South Quad in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think there are some people here, go blue. I knew these guys had marketed to the Michigan
community. Let the record show Michigan Alumni Association of Silicon Valley is out in force.
But I don't think I ever would have left that dorm room. I was so depressed. And then I saw a little note in the Michigan Daily. I mean, it was no more than 7 or 8 words. It said that Martin Luther King would be speaking on campus. And those of you who are from Ann Arbor, you know that in most places in the world, the rain comes vertical. But some days in Ann Arbor, the rain comes horizontal, and you can't really get across campus. And it was a day like that. And Martin Luther King spoke at Hill Auditorium that held 3,000 people. But there were hardly a couple hundred students who made it. And we walked into that cavernous hall. The president of the university was very embarrassed. There were so few people. Martin Luther King got on stage and just laughed when he saw the size of the crowd. He wasn't yet famous, hadn't yet won his Nobel Prize. Mississippi Summer hadn't yet happened. And I don't know really why I went, except that once I got there, he said, there aren't that many people in the audience. There's more of me to go around. You're all coming up here and stage with me. And we all sat with him for 6 hours.
6 hours?
And he spoke about a world where children would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, where the moral arc of the universe would be not on its own, but if you jumped up, grabbed it, and pulled it down, it would bend towards justice. And I'd never heard anybody talk like that before. And he said that there was something that I could do. And it meant to learn nonviolence and to sit on lunch counters and get hit on the back and learn not to react. And I could go down and march and be part of a movement. And I was depressed, and I had no inner core. I didn't know what I was going to do. But he came, and I changed my major from math and atomic physics to philosophy and ethics. And I marched with him. And I was arrested with Martin Luther King. I'm very proud of that, in Chicago, in one of the anti-war demonstrations. But nobody who was on stage with him that day was ever the same. We were infected with the virus of activism and became long-time activists. Almost, I'm still in touch with some of those kids that were there, and we were changed forever by meeting him.
Was it the idea that it was something bigger than yourself, something beyond you?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was something bigger than my depression. Mm-hmm. And my self, my solipsism. Mm-hmm.
And so that suggests that you maybe the legal path was the right one. But how did it evolve from there to becoming a physician?
Well, I sort of thought that I needed to do something that would save lives. And in my crazy idea, I thought, well, if I was a defense attorney, I could save people from being put to death wrongly, and if I was a doctor, I could save lives that way. But when my dad died, and I had applied to medical schools, I had applied to law schools in the East Coast, and I was going to go out for interviews. My mom said to me, "You think you're a moral person, and you're going to leave your mother, who has been widowed and lost her father?"
There is a reason we're here at Oshman. Let's be clear.
So I didn't go anyplace, and it was too late to apply for any school, and I happened to
I had my
wisdom teeth removed, a little nitrous oxide. I was driving my motorcycle downtown Detroit, and I noticed this building that was called Wayne Medical School. I didn't know that there was a Wayne Medical School. And I stopped my motorcycle, and I went in, and I asked to see the director of admissions, and he said, it's August, and school starts in September. And I said, yes. He said, did you take any pre-med courses? And I said, no. He said, well, have you taken the MedCats? And I said, no. And he went out, he disappeared, he came back in about 15 minutes. He said, we have some old, used MedCats here. Are you sure you've never seen them before? And I said, no, I've never seen them before. He said, would you be willing to take them right now? I said, sure. I mean, that was probably the nitrous oxide speaking. And I took them, and he went outside again, and he came back after 15 minutes. He says, there's got to be a reason for everything, but we've just had a cancellation. We've never done this before, but I suppose... Now, listen, he said, could you make me two promises before I offer you a place? He said, number one, you're not going to ask for any financial help. And two, you will graduate. You will stay here and graduate. And I said, yes. And he said, okay, well, I'll call you tonight. And he offered me a place in the class that was going to begin in 4 weeks.
It is an amazing story. And I have to say, having heard it now before, I'm realizing maybe this is part of the spiritual element of your life, that that fate was smiling on you as you were the nitrous oxide. I don't know, but something was causing you to smile. So you were there, and you went to medical school, and your mother must have been very pleased.
True. I did graduate.
You did not.
I did. No,
you
I
did.
Right. I never graduated from undergrad, but I graduated from medical school.
It was a different time. Let's just say it was a different time. And so you finished medical school, and you're ready to decide what kind of practice you want to do. But at that point,
well, while I was in medical school, one summer, Lyndon Johnson had created a bunch of government agencies to implement civil rights legislation. The 1965 Civil Rights Act, Title VI. Required all hospitals to cease segregation. And so they offered jobs to medical students to enforce Title VI of the 1965 Civil Rights Act. And I got a job working for an organization called the Office of Equal Health Opportunity. And that meant that I went to Washington, D.C. I became a federal officer. I had to swear allegiance. And in those days, There was a very strong anti-communist commitment you had to make, and I was sent down to Mississippi to try to integrate hospitals that had been segregated, and I was there for about 2 weeks. Then I was sent to Southern Ohio to try to integrate nursing homes, and then I don't know how this happened, but I got shipped to San Francisco in the middle of the Summer of Love. And that's not fair to do that to a young boy from Detroit, Michigan. I was totally unprepared. I was out without any weapons to combat the temptations of the Summer of Love, so I yielded.
Yeah, right. This is going to be played on radio, so this is a family show. So we will just sort of ask in the most general terms, how long were you in San Francisco?
Say it again.
How long was this? Was this just the summer?
Just the summer. Mm-hmm.
And let me guess, this summer experience caused you to decide that coming back to San Francisco would not be a bad thing.
Would be a good idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you finished medical school and you came to San Francisco?
I finished medical school and I got married, and my wife and I came back to medical school, Elliot.
Ah, that's right. But you want to actually, well, let's, we'll get to Gurgel in a couple minutes. So you came back to San Francisco, but, and the reason we're going through this sort of chronologically, but what's interesting is up until this point it was what I would describe as, and I wonder if you'd agree, a sort of traditional path with a strong moral element. Is that a fair
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, so many of my classmates went into medicine, got doctorates. We used to joke that the graduates of Mumford, 70 or 80% got doctorates. It's the high school.
Really?
Yeah.
And so you came to San Francisco, but even in San Francisco, when you got here, you were not the traditional physician. You were pushing the limits.
Well, because of that experience with Martin Luther King, I joined a group of radical organizations and Alphabet Soup, SNCC and CORE and SDS and Medical Committee for Human Rights. And we would wear white coats and have our stethoscopes ostentatiously dangling from our pockets as we marched in civil rights marches. And we became, my community became radical young doctors. And radical in those days meant that we didn't agree with the American Medical Association, which said that healthcare was a privilege and not a right. We believed this quaint notion that healthcare was a right for all, and that made us radicals. And the day that I began my internship at Presbyterian Hospital in San Francisco, which is the old Stanford Teaching Hospital and now is California Pacific, my picture appeared on the front cover of one of these magazines, medical magazines, and it said, "Beware, doctors, of these young radical MDs that are entering into our ranks." And the nice doctors at Presbyterian had made copies of that magazine and put it on all the nurses' stations with my face circled with a bullseye and a hypodermic needle in my nose and a little note saying that the Presbyterian Hospital welcomes its young radical doctor. Brilliant. So that was my introduction to the peace and love of San Francisco.
But I think, and that really is, in a certain sense, a beginning of what I'd call sort of the, I don't know, schizophrenia is too strong, but the divergence between the traditional path and what was accepted and your direction, which was challenging the status quo and finding a community that was not the the status quo community. Because you guys, as a doctor, you were pretty out there as a doctor in San Francisco.
Out there was my specialty. I mean, the docs at Presbyterian were great. And we agreed on one thing, which is good patient care. And we came together on that. And by the time I had finished my internship, we had really, I think, reached a great understanding with the physicians who were there before, which is we agreed on good medical care, regardless of who had long beards and long hair and who didn't.
And so, Todd, tell me about some of the other activities that sort of demonstrated your... your out there-ness.
My budding out there-ness.
Right.
So when I was finishing my internship, Herb Cain was a columnist in San Francisco, and Native Americans had taken over Alcatraz. Some of you may remember that the Treaty of Laramie says that land and goods can be taken from Native Americans, but if ever it is declared surplus federal property, it goes back to the ownership of the tribes from which it came. That's the Treaty of Laramie. And a group of Native Americans made an appeal to the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs asking that Alcatraz, when it was declared surplus property, would be returned to the tribes from which it came, and it was refused, joining a long list of treaties that were declined and not honored by us. Unfortunately. And so they took over Alcatraz. And a woman on Alcatraz, Lou Trudell, wanted to give birth to her baby on Indian-held land. And Herb Cain began every day writing this column. There's no water, there's no health care, there's no electricity on Alcatraz. This woman's going to give birth to her baby in a month, 29 days, 28 days, 27 days, 26. Is there no doctor willing to go out to Alcatraz to live there and deliver that baby? And I thought that was just an advertisement. Larry, come to Alcatraz. So I went to Alcatraz.
There was one, at least. And so you did.
I did. And that baby was named Wovoka. He is living in New Mexico. He is 6'5", and he played right interior lineman on the football team. And that name, Wovoka, had a magical quality to it, because the original Wovoka was a Paiute Sioux Indian medicine man who created the ghost dance religion, which Sitting Bull and Geronimo joined, and it became part of the Native American culture. And so the original Wovoka said that he would die, and he would circle the world, and he would come back. And when he came back, the Indian way would return. So when he was born on Alcatraz, it had tremendous cultural significance. And there was another young Indian on that island who had been a Green Beret, and he had perhaps had a little pharmacological support that night. And he began to slice his wrist because of the event and the feeling in the air. And I sewed him up after I delivered the baby, and he pulled out his stitches, and I sewed him up, and it got pretty...
Whereas, as I recall reading it, he stopped then focusing on his own arteries, and didn't he sort of go after you?
Yes. It was he was in an altered state, I believe you would say. And we medevaced him back to San Francisco. And when I got back to San Francisco, the ambulance took him to San Francisco General and did a great job and saved his life. And I was there, and it seemed like every television camera on Earth was also there, pointed at me, saying, "What do the Indians want?" And I had never met a Native American until 30 days before, and I was a pretty lousy person to ask that question, but I was the only one who had come off of the island. The next morning, I got a call from Warner Brothers that they had seen me on television, and they offered me a role in a movie that they were making, a little bit part to play a rock doc in a documentary or a rockumentary that was about hippies going the reverse way that the pilgrims had come, and it was going to be about the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane and Jethro Tull and Pink Floyd, and I was going to be
the natural progression for a young doctor.
Well, it was the normal career path in the 60s.
Right.
So I did it. And my wife and I joined this caravan called the Medicine Ball Caravan, this movie. And we went from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. We did a dozen rock concerts and filmed it. And then we flew to Canterbury for the final concert, which was Pink Floyd. And it was a great concert, Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, it was a great concert. I was mostly in the rock doc tent, but it was a terrific concert. And then some of the people that Warner Brothers had hired on the film included Wavy Gravy and the Hog Farm Commune. And the first time I met them was when I was asked to vaccinate the crew because they might be coming back in the United States. And I was to vaccinate them against smallpox. I had no idea what was in store for me on smallpox. I had never knew much about smallpox. But I remember meeting Wavy and in line as I was vaccinating him. And when he smiled, I saw that he had a full bridge of rainbow-colored teeth, Vibgyor, violet, indigo, blue, red, green, orange, yellow. And I knew that he was not like anybody I'd ever met before. And he had a duck bill hat that was made out of real duck's bill. And Wavy Gravy and I have been best friends for 40 years. It began on the set of that movie. And when we got, we finished the movie in Canterbury, Wavy wanted to continue. He wanted to buy a couple of buses in London and travel from England to Europe and go to Turkey and then through Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India.
The goal was Bangladesh, is that right?
This was all part of the 60s career path, and right. The old Silk Road became the hippie trail, and so we did that.
So is that the way you got to India?
Yeah, that was the way we got to India the first time.
And so, again, because this is the challenge, we only have an hour, and we've only mentioned the word smallpox once, So I do. There's a part of me that wants. Actually, I do want to digress one second, still on San Francisco, because it really, at least I, and maybe it says something about me, found it really fascinating the dichotomy again. You mentioned sort of pharmacologically challenged. You were in San Francisco at the time of the emergence of the whole movement around exploring yourself and unleashing potential through pharmacological enhancement. And people laugh, and it's sort of a joke at some point.
Are you asking me if I took LSD? No, are you having trouble with that question?
Not only am I not asking you, I have to say I had Larry over for dinner with my children, and he was giving an explanation about the good drugs and the bad drugs. But that's I'm really interested to have you talk about the challenge because we were joking about it, but you won't prescribe narcotics. You don't do prescription. And that's fascinating. You're a doctor, and that's clearly that there are reasons why people use these things to people's care.
I lost too many friends to a heroin needle stuck in their arm. I saw the dark side of narcotics, and so I never wanted to have a narcotics license. But I also saw the other side, and I don't recommend any drugs to anybody. But for me, when I was on that movie caravan, which was about 3 months, there wasn't a day that somebody, maybe not even an hour, that somebody didn't come by with LSD and say, do you want a hit? So it would have been impossible to not go through that experience without taking some psychedelics every day for 3 months. Now, I don't recommend this. Let's be clear, and that was a long time ago, 40 years ago, and I've not had any psychedelics since then. But that period of time and what it did to me, it did affect me dramatically. It opened me up to, a desire to explore more about the great religions and the spiritual traditions of the world. And so when Wavy suggested that we get on these buses and paint them psychedelic colors and drive through these little villages and these exotic places, I was thrilled. So we did.
You had the adventure. You did get to India, but you went. You came back, and then you decided. How did you get to India for the second time?
The second time. So I came back because Wavy was sick, and we wanted to get him into Roosevelt Hospital in New York, which he he did after setting the world's record for the most simultaneous diseases in one person. And my wife, then Elaine, stayed in India because she wanted to take meditation courses. And she wound up in the ashram of Neem Karoli Baba. In the middle of a war between India and Pakistan, I was in San Francisco and she was in the Himalayas, and we were trying to communicate with telegrams and phones that didn't work very well. And it went something like this: honey, come home, come back to San Francisco. You come here, meet with Baba. I didn't know who she was talking about. I couldn't quite understand. And then the war got worse, and Maharaji, as we call him, told all the Westerners to leave. And she called me just before Christmas, 1972. And she said, I will come home to San Francisco if you promise that you will come back to India and meet Neem Karoli Baba. And I promised. And she came back, and we paid off our medical school debts. I worked in an emergency room. And then we went back to India to go to this ashram called Kenshi. And if you think about India and China and Nepal, and you just put your finger where India and China and Nepal come together, that's where we lived for 3 years.
And so what was that experience like? And for a doctor, were you the doctor there?
Well, I mean, Maharaji gave me the name of Dr. America. So that was
a pretty funny... As if Dr. Brilliant wasn't enough, right.
Well, I didn't like it. Everybody else got names like Ram Das and Ravi Das. And I mean, I wanted to be one of the Das brothers. and I was called Dr. America. But it's hard to describe what it's like, obviously, living in a Hindu monastery.
You weren't sure it was going to work out.
Well, in the beginning, the first week, I was very unsure about it because there were all these idols. And coming out of a Judeo-Christian tradition, idols don't play real well with what we've learned. And it took me a while, and it took a little bit of these magical encounters that I had with my guru. I mean, you know, I think the only way that I can explain what it was like being there was that when I would sit in front of him, having gotten over my aversion to the idols, the touching of feet, the chanting of strange religious chants in a language I didn't understand. Well, actually, that sounded a lot like Hebrew, so that wasn't so bad. but I would sit in front of him, and it wasn't a surprise to me that he loved everybody in the world. It felt like that. I mean, that's what he emanated. That wasn't a surprise to me because that was his job. What was a surprise to me when I sat in front of him, I loved everybody in the world. And that was a real big surprise to me because I had come through the 60s. I had fought against the war in Vietnam. My friends had migrated from SDS into the Weathermen, and it was getting violent, which was one of the reasons I wanted to go to India, mm-hmm. was to not be part of that conflict. So living in the ashram, we settled into a routine where we would read the Hindu scriptures, the Buddhist scriptures, we'd read the Quran, we'd read the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Sikh Guru Granth Sahib. I mean, we would really try to understand all the great religions, and he would send us out to meet whatever spiritual teacher was in the neighborhood. Lama Govinda became a wonderful friend. Karmapa, the Dalai Lama. I mean, it was a magical and wonderful time. And I don't recommend drugs, but I do recommend Himalayan monasteries to anybody.
and it was his counsel or his prescription that led you to focus on smallpox.
So one day, while we were meditating, I mean, he gave everybody kind of an individualized path. And when I would sit and meditate off in a corner, he would frequently interrupt my meditations by throwing apples at me. And they seemed to be well aimed. after one or two apples in your testicles, you begin to realize that he's trying to tell you something. And I came up and he said to me, meditation, being alone in silence, these are really good things and you should do them. But in addition, there's something else I would like you to do. How much money do you have? Now that, you know, up until then,
it was
impossible to give him any money. Right. But once he said that, all that skepticism, right, that little, you know, that movie that goes in your head of the guru who asks you for money. And I said, I have $500. And he said, no, I don't mean here. I mean back in America. And I calculated that I had $500 back in America. I said, $500 back in America. He said, you're not lying, are you? I said, no. And he said, $500 here, $500 there. You are no doctor, which is what my mother said. But he said that in Hindi, and he kept saying it over and over again. $500, you are no doctor, you are no doctor, you are no doctor, in Hindi. And then he began saying it in English. You are no doctor. And then he started giggling and laughing. You are no doctor. You are no doctor. UNO doctor. UNO doctor. United Nations Organization doctor. You're going to be a UN doctor, and you're going to go to villages and give vaccinations because this terrible disease called smallpox is going to be eradicated. And you're going to join that team. Now, I don't pretend to understand how a fat old man in a blanket living in the Himalayas years before smallpox was eradicated could have even known the name smallpox, let alone said that it would be eradicated. And he used the Sanskrit word unmulan, which means literally to pull it out by the roots, which is what eradicate means. And how he could have thought that I could join the United Nations since I had never had a job. And I had hair down the middle of my back and a beard down to my knees, and I was wearing a gown. And he sent me looking like that. He said, go right now. And that was a long drive from the monastery in the Himalayas to the New Delhi office of the World Health Organization. It was about 17 hours. And I walked in to the office looking preposterous. And they kicked me out, as they well should have, and I came back up to the ashram. And he said, go back. And I did another 17 hours, and I got rid of the gown. I put on some pants, and they looked at me, and I looked preposterous, and they sent me out again.
At what point did you get the haircut?
About the 13th or 14th trip. I mean, I'm really, really dense. And then I got a jacket, and I got a tie. We're up to the 16th, 17th, 18th time that I did this trip. And I was pretty unhappy with this idea. And one day he said, go right now, this very second. You got to go right this very second. And I didn't want to do it. And my wife, who I love very much, said, you got to go. And we went together and we got there. And just as I walked into that WHO office, another American walked in. It was the first American I'd ever seen there in the WHO office. And he said to me, who are you? And I said, my name is Larry Brilliant. I'm a doctor, but I live in the Himalayas in a monastery. And my guru, who lives in the Himalayas, said, I'm supposed to join WHO because smallpox is going to be eradicated because this is God's will, and it's his gift to lift this burden of suffering from humanity. Who are you? And he said, I'm the head of the smallpox program. I'm here from Geneva. We don't have a smallpox program, but I'm supposed to meet with Mrs. Gandhi tomorrow and try to talk her into it. He said, but, you know, since we're here, should I interview you? And he did, and he interviewed me. And 10 years later, after I had worked for the UN for a decade, and he had left me in charge of the smallpox program in India for a while, he sent me back to clean out all the records and turn off the lights because we had eradicated smallpox. And I found the note that he had written about me on that day. It said, I have today interviewed a young man named Larry Brilliant. He says he's a doctor. He doesn't look like one. And he appears to have gone native.
I actually think that might qualify as an understatement.
He passed away 4 weeks ago, D.A. Henderson, and we're going to go to his funeral in 2 weeks. He was a great man, became the dean of Johns Hopkins.
And really was one of the authors of the the strategy behind.
Well, the author of the strategy was Bill Foege. Bill Foege is another amazing man. He became the head of CDC and the head of the Carter Center. You know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. The five people that I worked with in the smallpox program all got the highest honor that their country could give them. Bill and D.A. got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and Isao Arita got the Japan Prize, and Nicole Grasset got the French Legion of Honor, and M.I.D. Sharma, who was like my father in that program, he got the Padma Shri. I mean, this was an amazing group of people who came together. I was the mascot on the team. I was hired. They had to create a job category low enough that they could justify hiring a hippie. I mean, really. And I got to work with these giants in the field of public health. And of course, we all have these formative moments in our life. And working with people like that and being able to understand the history of a disease which was probably 10,000 years old. It killed billions of people. It's a disease which killed 500 million people in the 20th century. During the Summer of Love, when I was here in San Francisco, 2.5 million people died in the world from smallpox. I didn't know that. And I was able to see the last case of variola major in the world, a little girl named Rahima Banu in Bangladesh. And when she coughed, and she survived smallpox, 1 out of 3 died from smallpox. That was Elliot coughing, but not from smallpox. I can guarantee you that was not smallpox. I just positively, I don't know much, but I know he does not have smallpox. But when that little girl, you too, huh? When Rahima Banu coughed and the virus left her body and it landed on the ground in Bangladesh and the sun killed it and there were no susceptible people, that was the end of an unbroken chain of transmission of a disease that went back to Pharaoh Ramses V, that was probably one of the plagues in the Bible. It was probably what the boils that Job had. And that was the end of one of the worst, if not the worst, diseases in history. And I got to see the last case of it. People ask me why I'm an optimist. If you were a young doctor from Detroit, Michigan, you got to see the last case of the worst disease in history. How could you not be an optimist?
So I have to, I'm now getting deluged with questions, but one is sort of perfect for this moment. You've described sort of the extraordinary, some would say spiritual timing, some might say coincidences, that led you to this extraordinary scientific endeavor. How do you reconcile science with the spiritual experiences you had with Baba Karoli in India?
I don't have any problem at all reconciling them.
Conflicts? Are they two sides of the same coin?
Oh, you know, I mean, I remember when I was at Temple Israel in Detroit, in my confirmation class, our rabbi asked us all to write an essay on how you had to choose between God and science. And everybody else wrote that essay and made that choice. And I said, how can I choose? And he said, well, let me see what your essay is. And I wrote an essay saying, I choose both. And this was, I was 16. And he said, I'm going to kick you out of class for that. And he did. He kicked me out of confirmation class. But I've still made that same choice. I choose both. The best scientists that I know, the greatest minds in physics or in medicine, are motivated by a spiritual calling. And the greatest spiritual people I know, like the Dalai Lama, they're totally committed to understanding science. The Dalai Lama holds meetings with the great neuroscientists every year. He's got one of the wonderful inquiring minds. I don't think you have to choose one. I think you can choose both.
So then let's take it another way. How do you reconcile the presence of God or spirituality with the presence of so much suffering from smallpox?
Yeah, that's a hard question. That is the question about which many religions are based. I certainly had my struggles with suffering. I've probably seen hundreds, maybe thousands of little babies die of smallpox. It is very difficult to not be angry at God when you see that kind of death and suffering. And I spent lots of days angry. And I can't answer that question. I mean, you know, Hindus will answer that question by saying that reincarnation accounts for that. But I can't imagine a God that would require anyone to go through a death from a disease like smallpox because of something that they did in a previous life or a parent did. I can't reconcile it.
How do you recognize a spiritual person, or you've had this range of exposure, whether it's Martin Luther King, Baba Karoli, Bill Fagey, Dale Henderson. You know, what do they have in common? Do you see commonality, or
that's
do
a good
each...
question? They don't have a lot in common. I think that.
Or do you have to find what connects to you in each of them?
Well, I think all of us have met people in our life who...
Yeah, but you've just met so many more.
I'm just older. I think that we've all met people in our life who turn us on, mm-hmm. who make us light up, who are lit up themselves, and we get something from them. We get nurtured. Some part of us gets fed by something that they're committed to. At the Skoll, every year Skoll has a meeting in Oxford, and we bring 1,000 young social entrepreneurs. And they might be working on blindness, or they might be working on toilets in Orissa, or women's rights, or stopping female genital mutilation, or working on legal rights for Native Americans. But they have a light in their eyes, mm-hmm. and a searchlight in their forehead, and being around them is every bit as magical to me as it is being in an ashram in the Himalayas. You know, when you feel people like Martin Luther King, who had that total, absolute commitment to service, to a world that would be better, that's one of the things that feeds you and that changes you. And if I was going to recommend anything to people, it's search out those searchlights. Find those people who have that light in their eyes for whatever reason they get it, and learn from them, and learn what is that light and why are they infused in it, because it will change your life.
So I want to mention some of them, and I'd love to get your sort of encapsulation or crystallization of, you know, this sort of our lightning round of Larry Brilliant as Zelig of the second half of the 20th century. Robert Kennedy.
So my dad was asked by Robert Kennedy to testify in the McClellan Committee, the Committee Against Organized Crime, because my dad was in the jukebox business. And I never met him, but apparently he came to our house, my mother tells me. And he was extraordinarily kind to our family and wrote us letters. I think he's a great, great American hero.
Allen Ginsberg.
Well, I remember Allen Ginsberg on Hippie Hill in Golden Gate Park, chanting Om and singing Hare Rama, Hare Krishna, which was the first time I'd ever heard Om or Hare Rama, Hare Krishna. And then years later, when I heard him read his poem, Howl, I think that... And if you really want to read an interesting book, read Allen Ginsberg's record of his time in India. That's a pretty interesting book.
Benjamin Spock.
Ben Spock was my mentor when I was in medical school. He was the baby doctor.
You may need for the radio audience, because I'm sure the audience here knows exactly who he was, but you may want to...
Ben Spock was a professor of medicine at Case Western Reserve Medical School in Cleveland, Ohio. He was the baby doctor.
He wrote
the book called Baby and Child Care. And
which was the Bible for a certain generation.
The Bible of raising children in those days. And he was against the war in Vietnam. He wore a three-piece suit and had a watch fob and claimed to come from an old unbroken chain of Yankees. And he would get himself arrested at every peace march that he could, and he was arrested for conspiracy. And he He went to court and he explained that the word conspire means to breathe together, and he loved to breathe together with other people who were against the war in Vietnam.
So how did you meet the Dalai Lama?
You mean the first time?
Yes.
The first time, my wife and I were looking for smallpox cases in the southern part of Madhya Pradesh. And we had had a very bad day and gotten bit by mosquitoes and fleas and bed bugs, and we were covered with monkey piss, and it was a really bad day. And we escaped across the border to Maharashtra state, and they had a circuit house, a government circuit house, and we had a Jeep that said United Nations on it, so we were allowed to stay in the fancy circuit house. And we went in and took showers. And they were not real showers. They give you a bucket of water, and they heat up the water. And we had just put the water over our heads. And we were both coming out of the shower area, not exactly fully clothed, but, you know, kind of wearing a towel around us. And there was a big knock on the door. And the chowkidar, the man who ran the circuit house, he said, "I'm sorry, you're going to have to leave. A more important person has come, and you've been bumped." And we were feeling really bad about that because we had had a very bad day the night before. And we had just had our bath, and we really wanted to go to sleep. And we started putting our clothes back on, and bursting through the door was the Dalai Lama, which doesn't make any sense at all. But it was. And it took him about a nanosecond, and he got it. He looked at the one bed that was in the room, and my wife and I, that had just come out of the, you know, the hot water bucket, and he said these sacred words. He said, "We can share."
Not very many of you in the audience or listening will have ever heard from or met someone who slept with a Dalai Lama.
But I have to tell you, it's one of the great failings of my entire life, because like everybody here, we all want to ask the Dalai Lama the meaning of life. I certainly wanted to ask the Dalai Lama the meaning of life. And here we were in a circuit house in southern India, and we had a lot of time. And I thought, God, I'm going to ask him the meaning of life. I'm going to ask him the meaning of life. I'm going to ask him the meaning of life. Got to ask him the meaning of life. How should I ask him? And then I looked down on his arm, and I saw that he had 4 vaccination marks from smallpox. And I just forgot to ask him the meaning of life. And I said, "Where'd you get those 4 vaccination marks?" He said, "I was a small boy in Lhasa and Ladrup," which was the Tibetan name for smallpox. There was a huge epidemic, and everybody wanted to make sure the young Dalai Lama survived. And there were 4 sects, and each one of them wanted to vaccinate me with a horrible rotary lancet. So I have 4 vaccination marks. And then I fell asleep. And I mean, I will carry for the rest of my life this notion of missed opportunity. And I have had the pleasure of meeting the Dalai Lama many times after that. And if you have a chance to listen to him, he's amazing. He's the real deal.
A couple of other people, and then want to go back to more questions. Just, it would be wrong, since we're, you know, in Silicon Valley, not to ask about a couple of other people. One early on, and again, I hope the audience is familiar, Stuart Brand.
Stuart Brand. Stuart Brand was a merry prankster. He was a biologist, and he was part of the early 60s movements, and he then started the Whole Earth Catalog.
Which in many ways, I have to say, in the well, which in many ways was the precursor to social networking today.
That's right. So Stuart and I each owned half of the well. We started the Whole Earth Electronic Link, which the company that Elliot now works for, Facebook, is a poor imitation of the well, which was the first social network. I'm sure that the people at Facebook think about this all the time.
more frequently than you would think. We are very aware of the tradition. So but he was quite instrumental in your paying off your debts, as I recall, in San Francisco, right? To enable you to get back to India. Didn't he give you copies of the catalog to pay off?
This is way a long time ago.
Yeah.
When I was first here, I was the editor of a radical medical magazine called The Body Politic. And we had 5,000 subscribers who had prepaid $15 each for their subscription. And I was racked with guilt about going back to India and leaving my subscribers, and Stuart gave me 5,000 copies of the Whole Earth Catalog and mailed them out to each one of my subscribers. And I must say, not one of them wrote back and said, I would have preferred to have the body politic.
So, and the other person, of course, would be remiss in not raising Steve Jobs. And talk a little bit about the connection there, both in India and also in the work that continues today, a legacy that people here may not.
I met Steve when he was 19 years old. He had come to India to meet Neem Karoli Baba and got there too late. And Maharaji had already died. And I had by then become a UN official, and my office building was air-conditioned and served salads. At that time, he was barefoot and had shaven his head and wasn't getting much food. And he came, like 5 minutes earlier, I had been barefoot and a hippie, and I would find any of people who were sympathetic to spiritual seekers and who had jobs in air-conditioned rooms that had salads. And then it was my turn. I had an opportunity to give him lunch at the World Health Organization when he was 19. And then years later, when we started the Seva Foundation, he gave us the first money to start it. But not just the money. He gave me a computer to work on the Nepal Blindness Program that led to the creation of the software that became The Well. And he was always a great friend. And
talk a little bit about Seva for people who may not be familiar with it. In many ways, it's a
Seva was started after we eradicated smallpox. I know when you say that, it sounds really like after we eradicated smallpox. But after we eradicated smallpox, we wanted to do something else. It was like, you know, you climb a mountain, you want to climb another one. And many of us got together, and we started an organization called the Seva Foundation. It initially meant Society for Epidemiology and Voluntary Assistance. But Seva is a Sanskrit word which means service. We like that word very much. And Steve gave us the money and became a member of Seva. And we went, since we were founded 40 years ago, Seva has given back sight to 4 million people in over 2 dozen countries.
You want to mention the movie, the documentary?
Oh, so if you have HBO or you can get this movie we just made called Open Your Eyes, which is about some of the work that Seva does in Nepal.
It's an extraordinary film. I really recommend it. I'm told I have time for one last question. I'm going to indulge and do two. If you were young today, which radical cause would you fight for? And I object to the friend young today. If you were younger today.
All of them. I mean, it's not just one cause. I mean, of course, climate change, of course, women's rights. I mean, you could start listing them, decreasing the delta between the rich and the poor, saving San Francisco from its successes. I mean, there's so many things that I would be attracted to. But it's much more important to find common community with people who are searching and willing to work alongside of you. That's a bigger cause than any of the others.
And so the true last question that I'm going to ask is one that I thought was particularly appropriate from the audience. After all of that, the India, the drugs, the ashrams, the smallpox, what did your mom think of your career?
Okay, I'm going to tell one joke about Sergey Brin. Because we were together in Davos at a Saturday night dinner, which is held in Davos every year. It's called the Nerds Dinner. It's the hardest ticket to get at the World Economic Forum. And every one of us had to give a little seven-word definition of who we are. And I'll never forget what Sergey did. He'll kill me for telling you this. But his was, Google Schmoogle, finish PhD, Mom says. And that's a pretty good definition of what my mom told me, without the Google part.
Larry, thank you very much, and thank you all for your excellent questions.
Thank you. Thank
you. I hope and trust you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Ashman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Larry Brilliant, author of Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Elliot Schrag, Vice President of Communications and Public Policy at Facebook, our wonderful audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now this meeting is adjourned.